Alan Grant. You look the same.
Oh.
And this place, you.
Welcome to the Three Men in a Retrospective Podcast, Jurassic Park Retrospective Series.
This is how you make dinosaurs?
No. This is how you play God.
Join Garrett.
You command respect. People believe you.
Matt.
Can I get you something and a beer? Or...
And Adam.
Gee, the lack of humility before nature that's being displayed here staggers me.
As they take a tour of one of cinema's most popular franchises.
Dear heavens, I think we're back in business.
Will Matt make more enemies than some out-of-reach dino food?
Our scientists have done things which nobody's ever done before.
Yeah, but your scientists were so preoccupied with whether or not they could, they didn't stop to think if they should.
And where does Adam stand on yet another film series started by the Beard?
Oh, that's discouraging.
Find out the answers to these questions and more on this podcast, 65 Million Years in the Making.
These are aggressive living things that have no idea what century they're in, and they'll defend themselves violently if necessary.
Courtesy of Percolated Media.
Hang on to something!
Jurassic World, released June 12, 2015. Budget was $215 million. Box office, $1.6 billion. Wow, were people hungry for dinosaurs. And this was directed by Colin Trevorrow. Well, two podcast years and 14 real years later... we are getting to Jurassic World. Matt, 14 years after Jurassic Park 3, did you ever think we'd see dinosaurs on the big screen again?
Well, it's only two in T-Rex years, but who's counting? So the answer with Jurassic Park proper is yes, because it's a license to print money, as this one certainly attested to. But dinosaurs are cross-generational, and I think that's kind of why the appeal has always been there. Not just exclusive to this franchise, but we've seen plenty of other ones do prehistoric times and dinosaurs. They've always been around. I mean, 65 million years is certainly a tremendous amount of real estate to work with. But I was always curious if we would get another one, because when I was growing up as a teenager, they talked about Jurassic Park 4. That thing had more starts and stops than a Fast and Furious movie, which explains why this one took 14 years to grace the screen. And apparently people were lined up at the gate to see it, because holy shit, I totally forgot that this thing made over $1.5 billion in a summer with Age of Ultron, and we had a new Star Wars movie that year. First one in a decade, we had Terminator, Mission Impossible. That was a pretty loaded summer, and for this to stand out almost on par with a goddamn Avengers movie is pretty impressive.
Mad Max. Don't forget Mad Max. Yeah, that was quite a loaded summer. And I remember I went to a screening of this. This was when I was still working for the studio system. And we had passes and everything. And I was able to go and I was able to post a review on the site. That review is still up on my Letterboxd. And I'll talk about whether I still feel that way. But I was not too positive on this when I came out of it. Adam, 14 years later, did you ever think we'd see a new Jurassic Park movie?
I definitely thought we'd eventually get a Jurassic Park movie. I never thought that they would take the shift that they did. It's one of those, I thought maybe they would be fully buying the rights or something like that, because Spielberg, I mean, his name is on things, you know, they get done later on, but I didn't think the Beard would ever be coming back and be involved. So to see this done the way that it was, I mean, for those that go to Universal Studios, you know, Jurassic Park has always been a part of their theme park legacies. They built on it and they've built out a lot since this, but it's almost kind of like King Kong and some of those other ones. You know, monsters do well, and dinosaurs in the Jurassic Park vein are they're monster movies. So I knew it eventually would come back, but this thing, holy hell. I mean, they found a take, and I think is what was important for this thing to be the success that it was.
Well, you guys say these were guaranteed successes, but the last one, Jurassic Park 3, wasn't that big of a success in 2001. It was looked at as old hat. So I myself was... I was not really thinking we'd ever get another one, at least one not from Steven Spielberg. So that was my feeling. And Matt, you mentioned the development of this. My God, there are so many legs to this. I'm only going to talk about a few of them, but there was a script written by William Monahan, who, Matt, you and I, we discussed him when we talked about The Departed. I mean, he was an Oscar-winning screenwriter. He comes on board, and he writes a script that was rejected pretty quickly, but it involved drug dealers, it involved trained dinosaurs, which we're going to kind of see when we get into this. But, Matt, had you heard about and seen the concept art that they had developed for this?
Well, I know a lot about the various developments of this movie because this was during the time where people were making fan posters of anything and everything. And I remember the talk, it wasn't exclusive to this script you're talking about, but they talked about and apparently got pretty far on the idea of doing human dinosaur hybrids. Mm-hmm. And I thought to myself, as ridiculous as that sounds, gene splicing in the context of Jurassic Park would actually be kind of befitting, because that leads me more to taking this in a horror-tinged direction, which these movies kind of do to varying degrees, but they never fully commit. I thought if you were going to reboot it, taking that approach, as implausible as it sounds, would have been something I was interested in. But as far as trained dinosaurs for combat and all that, with, I guess, like they had a mercenary that was leading mm-hmm. them, it sounded interesting, but I also don't think that would have done particularly well, because that would have been, what, 2-3 years after the third one? Yeah. I don't think the demand mm-hmm. would have been there necessarily.
Yeah, it's going that kind of route. I think they needed distance. I think they needed time. You know, they didn't need to go a complete different age, but absence makes the heart grow fonder.
And then this did go through various stages. John Sayles came on and wrote a version of this. And then Spielberg brought on a guy who wrote The Cell, and he also worked on the first Thor movie, Mark Protasevich. He was brought on board. Various scripts were done, and Joe Johnston was on board of this. And then Captain America came around, and he's like, you know what? I'm sick of waiting. I'm just going to go ahead and jump on that project. Then they brought on Rick Jaffa and Amanda Silver, who, boys, the three of us talked about when we talked about Planet of the Apes. They wrote a lot of that final set of movies.
Yeah, I know they wrote the first two of the circus films and then were involved in producing roles, but they were also writers on the most recent Avatar movie.
Yes. They were brought on board to do a script that, and you know, Adam, you mentioned that Spielberg's name is on this, and it doesn't always mean he's very involved. He was very involved in the development of this. In fact, when these guys were brought on to write this, they incorporated three ideas from Spielberg, which was a fully functioning dinosaur theme park, a human who has a relationship with trained raptors, and a human eating dinosaur that escapes and has to be stopped. Those were the three things that Spielberg requested beyond this. And if you have the beard funding your movie, you better put those in, and we are going to get those.
We are, though, to be fair, one of those is from Michael Crichton himself with the
work.
But yeah, I think when Spielberg goes, yes, we're going to do it. Yes, you can use the Amblin name, which holds, I mean, you're getting funded when you do that. And I love that he was involved. I do think he has a passion for this still. I think he cares so much about what the legacy is. I think he wanted to kind of redeem what 2 and 3 was, at least how they're looked at. You know, we talked about them. I don't think any of us crapped on those movies, massively. Second one we thrashed, but they have their place. But I do think he wanted to bring that kind of magic back to a new generation. You know, when you separate it out by almost 15 years, your 5-year-olds are 20-year-olds. They have kids now. So that's kind of what this is for me, and I appreciate him for it. You know, I was growing up. Well, guess what? I get kids, and I get to now take kids to a Jurassic Park film. And I think that's what the beard wanted to do for the next generation.
Now, I mentioned my viewing experience with this, and I hadn't really seen this since I reviewed this over at the old place. Matt, you mentioned you saw this just in theaters that one time.
I saw it once and I had my fill. I didn't hate it. That's the thing. Like when I say I've only seen it once and it's been 10 years, that leads to the assumption that I just hated it and never wanted to watch it again. The reality is it kind of came and went in my consciousness, but I'm sort of the opposite of the box office revenue, so it's good that they didn't use my brain waves for the test audiences, because apparently people went crazy for it. Maybe it was just lightning in a bottle. Maybe it was just the marketing, which was certainly very well promoted, not just with the advertising on TV and film, but around this time there were rumblings that they were actually going to revamp parts of the Universal theme parks befitting the world name. So it seemed like they were both confident in it, but also understood that, hey, we have the potential to touch a whole new generation, which this really does. I mean, regardless of what we have to say, this is very much The Force Awakens, not just because it came out the same year, but it's that same type of new generation appeal for an existing property. And to your point about Spielberg, he was more involved in this than he was in Dial of Destiny.
Or if you ask me, The Lost World, but that's another story that we already talked about. Adam, your film-going experience, did you see this in theaters? You take the kids? You said mentioned you had kids when this one was out. Did you take them to this?
Kind of all of the above. Our first watch as a family, because at this point the kids were 7 and 4. Let's see, 2015. Yeah. So I think our first viewing was drive-in, just because you don't know how a 4-year-old's going to react, you know, something like this giant on screen. And it was an amazing experience for all of us. I mean, you're talking summer drive-in, sitting in the seats outside the car. It was enough that they wanted to go back the next week and see it in the movie theater.
Oh, you got, so you went like, to the right, drive-in?
Drive-in for the first show. Second show, movie theater. The kids decided they wanted this to be seen in a movie theater. I believe it was Alex's first big screen experience of this kind of movie that wasn't, you know, I think a Pixar movie we'd seen years before. And then the kids took me a third time to see it in theaters. So this was one of those where my kids could not have enough. We saw it as a family is in the drive-in, family in theater, and then the kids and myself for a third time. So this box office was done by people like us who kept going back to see it.
Yeah, and we did. And as a result, we are going to get how many more? 3 more movies? Yeah, 3 more,
well,
right?
Two more as part of a series, and then this new one is apparently starting a new trend. Like, it's a second reboot.
So we're going to get
anywhere from 3 to 5 more after this.
Yeah, and you know what? I've only seen the next one. I have not seen after Fallen Kingdom. So this set of the retrospective is going to be mostly new viewings for me.
And I will say, not just this movie, but since the years that this movie came out, it's done, I think, 2 different animated series that have been spinoffs of this, a couple seasons each. My kids devoured those animated series.
They did an animated series of this?
Oh, yeah. Oh, wow. Jurassic World, Camp Cretaceous, and there's another one. And they love them. But it's the same way that Star Wars Rebels and Star Wars The Clone Wars is kind of my kids' Star Wars now. That's what they, you know, go to. And so they love those. They love the game where it's kind of like a build your own Jurassic Park video game. Yeah. Alex and I have put ridiculous amounts of hours into those. So not just the movie themselves, but this thing branched out and branded itself. And I think it did get a new generation.
I have another theory, though, that may have led to some additional revenue. If you recall in the previous movies, all three of them were not headlined by huge stars. Jeff Goldblum's a name, but he's not going to sell a movie. We have to remember this is a year after Guardians of the Galaxy, and Chris Pratt had become bankable, or at least considerably more well-known than he had ever been on television or other roles. He's front and center on the poster riding that motorcycle with the Raptors. I'm not going to say he vastly contributed to the take of this movie, but it doesn't hurt to have someone that people are riding high off of. Certainly in comparison to the previous movies.
Especially that international, because this thing, it did almost $700 million here in the States, but it did over $1 billion overseas. That's massive.
Well, if we're going to talk about this movie, we need to talk about who eventually ended up helming this thing.
Speaking of Star Wars.
Yeah. Now, Colin Trevorrow had done one movie before this, a little known movie called Safety Not Guaranteed. At least it was a little known before this had come out.
That is a very reflective title, though, for this movie.
You're not
kidding. It's very appropriate.
Yeah. Now, Matt, had you seen that before this had come out? And had you heard of Colin Trevorrow before this? We even saw this?
No, I didn't see this till well after the I didn't see Safety Not Guaranteed until well after the fact. But I certainly really liked it. In fact, I saw the Book of Henry before I saw that movie.
Wow. Adam, had you heard of Colin Trevorrow before this?
I've not heard of him before that. And you know what? Come to think of it, I don't think I've heard of his name since. So, well, very quickly. But no, I know of Safety Not Guaranteed. Never seen it. Such a crazy pick for such a massive, massive film. When you talk about certain genders and ethnicities getting favored deals in Hollywood, you can't look at something like this and not go, fucking A, they're right.
Well,
especially this is also, though, in line with what Marvel was doing, taking filmmakers who had only done one movie. I mean, they were starting to do this. I mean, at least early on, they got Joe Johnston, Kenneth Branagh, Favreau, Shane Black, people who had experience.
When it was done under Universal Marvel?
Right, when it was Paramount. And then after that, they started getting television directors. I mean, this is the Russo brothers really kicked off that trend. This is very in tune with that logic.
So we open up with the Universal logo as well as the Amblin logo and the Legendary Pictures logo as we see an egg crack as something is making its way out. This almost reminded me of Gremlins with all these eggs just kind of being shown and these things being coming out. We're going to see a lot of references to Spielberg's old work.
This is, it's fitting that it opens with an egg because this thing is Easter egg from credit to credit. So don't, you take a shot every time there's an Easter egg and you're not going to make it till they get to the island.
It's also very appropriate because this movie feels like it was grown in a lab.
Because I don't know, man. Not as much as Force Awakens. I don't think it feels that way.
No. It's not. But that also had much more baggage. Definitely. That they were trying to overcome. Here, though, I'm annoyed right away. And I hate to sound like I'm bitching already, but hear me out, please. Right away, I'm taken out because 22 years before this, we saw practical eggs being hatched. And they looked far more convincing than these.
Wow. I don't know about that. I wasn't taken out because of the eggs in the opening shot, Matt.
Well, I'm already getting annoyed because I'm like, that first movie, even the sequels, were pioneers for practical effects and puppetry and animatronics. I feel like Ian Malcolm already were. I'm like, it didn't require anything to obtain this. You're just doing it because you have the ability, not because you should.
I think
now some of the CG in this is pretty damn good, though. I'm not gonna chastise it completely, but I also think there are spots where it's a bit shaky, and it's even in this opening because I know there's nothing there. Like, there's clearly an artifice with every layer.
Adam, you took your kids to this. Did you guys see this in 3D?
No, not in any of them.
No, because I do think the 3D lends a lot. So we cut to not a dinosaur, but a bird planting its feet on the ground as Judy Greer sees her kids off to a trip to see their aunt, who for sure can handle two more kids, can't she? And we're hearing that Isla Nublar now has 14 herbivores and 6 carnivores. So this takes place 22 years after the first one, boys, and we're definitely going to see references to it. But here, they answer the question right away. Why open a park after what happened the first time?
I think this is actually, there's parts of this movie that are great satire on the commercialization of not just a theme park, but this property in general, because it literally made its way into actual theme parks in both California and Florida. I also think, though, it's an appropriate amount of time. Like, if you did this 5 years later, it would have been ridiculous. You also had to wait for technology to catch up. But I also appreciate that they set it in contemporary times. Like, they didn't feel the need to go 50 years in the future, where there's flying cars and things like that. It still feels like modern day. But as far as the setup goes, I greatly appreciate they just throw you right in. You don't have to wait to see the park. It's already the opposite of the first one. Mm-hmm. Now, granted, the first one, it's like a test run. So there's buildup, but that's also a commentary on today's audiences. I hate to say it, most people are dumb and they want their fill right away. They don't want to wait.
For sure. And you mentioned the satire. I do see the satire all over this. We're going to see Pandora jewelry here. Colin Trevorrow was out in the press around this time saying he went to a variety of parks, Disney and otherwise, that they took notes on just to see how much of a commercialized environment these parks really are. And I see that here. I see the commercialization right away.
I think it's an amazing setup. I will give the trailers a lot of credit, because they kind of need to let you know what you're going in for. If you went into this just completely raw, this thing throws you in a deep end. There's no net. There's no stairs to climb out of. You better hope you can follow along. It doesn't wait. And I got to say, I could not believe this movie's only 2 hours long. Like, that blew me away and I'd forgotten. It is 2:04 and that's kind of nuts. Judy Greer, it's amazing that you pull her out here for such a thankless, role. I love, love, love the meta theme park and commercialization discussions that this movie has from start to end. It is glorious, and I think it's part of why this movie works for me on just multiple layers, even to the point that when they get here, these escalators that you see throughout this place, if you have ever been to Universal Studios Hollywood, the upper lot is on the top of a freaking hill, and it has the steepest, most crazy zigzag escalators to get down to the lower lot. And the fact that they're willing to take a shot at themselves is just fucking great.
Well, even the monorail technology, that's straight out of Disney, the big yep. Gates. I like that. I also like that you can clearly tell they just built upon what was already there.
Yeah.
Which they reference multiple times. I mean, you literally see the foundation later on in the movie. I think that's also kind of a wink and a nod that this movie was built upon a predecessor.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, though. Whenever I hear Judy Greer, I just hear Cheryl. It takes me out every time.
From Archer.
Oh, from Archer, yes. Now,
okay. I'm my supervisor. We see the kids try and find Aunt Claire, but they just get her assistant, who... Did you guys recognize her? We just reviewed her.
Yeah, she was in...
She was the sister in Ballerina. Yeah. I had no idea.
I thought you were going to mention Supergirl.
Oh, yeah, that's right. She was in that, too. So they hop on a clear window tram, taking them through the original Jurassic Park as we hear the original theme in all its glory. Michael Giacchino's here as composer. I have ripped him to shreds on this podcast. Here, he only works when he's recycling old themes that John Williams has already done.
This, I love the score in this that is done by John Williams.
Yeah.
I mean, to me, that's kind of what it is. The times that they play it up and they try to, they do like half a John Williams like score and then change it. That's like the beginning of Rogue One to me. And I want to throw my fucking soda at the douchebag in front of me, you know, in a theater. I hate when they do that. But when it is that John Williams swell, it is like nothing else. And I got to say, you know what I get? I get two children of mine walking out of a theater going, na, 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 na. And they will still do that to this day. I wish John Williams, I wish I could tell him that music is magic in placing some of this stuff. And that is iconic decades later, and it will never go away. It is the Jaws theme. It is the Raiders theme. It sticks with them.
Yeah. And Jaws, Raiders, Jurassic Park, Harry Potter, all those can be found at theme parks.
Yep.
And on our podcast. Meanwhile, Claire says that nobody is impressed by a dinosaur anymore, and as their DNA discovers new species every day, genetics and their various combinations have opened up even more windows. Here's what I respect this movie for, boys. I want to go ahead and say this. I want to go out on a limb. I think the script is pretty smart in that it's pointing out we're not really doing dinosaurs. We're doing genetic mutations and versions of dinosaurs. So the fact that they're messing with this and they're calling it out, I really respect that.
I do too. I think it's also taking shot at movies at this point. You know, people don't want, you know, Matt brought up the point earlier. People aren't willing to sit and wait. You know, they want bigger, stronger, faster. It was a shot, I think, at the way that franchise, that F word that I can't stand so much, you know, for movies we're going. So this is just, it is so meta that Facebook might as well fucking rip off the name and sue for it. Like, it is, when you think about what was able to get through the script, where so many executives would, you know, if this was done at WB, they would have ripped it apart because they never would allow that kind of commentary to be done. It's, I think it works on a different level for people that want more than just monsters and theme parks. It's smart.
It's smart, but I think it's inconsistent at times too. Not necessarily with the way it's kind of commentating on, I don't want to call it like homogenization of movies. And I do like that everything's like a perversion of what John Hammond set out to do, even though it's run by a benevolent guy, which I appreciate that they didn't do like the second one where they just make the his like nephew the big like mustache twirling villain. I thought that's what we were setting up. What I don't understand is, okay, Sam Neill didn't want to come back. Jeff Goldblum, Laura Dern, all of them had come back for a sequel. Who's the one person we could get? Vidi Wong answers the phone, and in this movie, he is one... It's alive away from being Victor Frankenstein. Like, I don't understand this trajectory of a guy who has like one scene in the first movie to being the evil mad scientist of this entire trilogy.
Yeah, I was just getting to that. It's unbelievable that that was the one cast member they could bring back.
I mean, I would have thought this would have been the way to get Tim to come back as an adult. If he was a tech advisor at the park or something. Because really, there's only a handful of characters who would... previously established characters who could come back and it would make sense. Because you know, if damn good and well, Grant would be like, I'm not stepping foot in that park.
And Tim was the rumor of who one other character was actually gonna be.
We then hear about the Indominus Rex, who was engineered and designed by good old B.D. Wong, as me and Matt have mentioned. Now, what I like about this is we're not getting teased mostly throughout this. In that first movie, we're getting teased about the T-Rex, and then they eventually see it in all its glory about an hour or so in. Here, we're getting hints at it. We're seeing it as it's being enclosed, and I like the way this Indominus Rex is revealed.
I wish they came up with a better name. This is one of those, I wish they did what Jake Johnson talks about, Verizon presents the Indominus Rex or something, because it's such a, you know, it's such a good, like, corporatization that they would sponsor dinosaurs since all the names have already been, I guess, taken.
Yeah.
So you have to, like, you know, go to the highest bidder. That's the spare no expense part of Hammond's mission statement that they kind of twist. And design-wise, I think it's fine, but... I have to question that there's a big surprise that's revealed as part of its DNA. And I'm like, I can tell just by looking at the damn thing. Why are you all shocked?
You know what? This is going to be a little surprising based on how much I've been praising the heck out of it. I don't care for the changes to dinosaurs. to me, I think that's where some of it falls short.
This one specifically, or all of them?
Well, stay tuned, because this is only the first one we've gotten so far. But I get it from a story structure standpoint. I get it from the story they're trying to tell, and the look at capitalism and theme parks and more and more and more. I just don't necessarily care for it. To Matt's point, I think the name is stupid.
I didn't say that.
Okay, I'll say it. I think the name is stupid. Well, hang on. It's not the worst one. So I think they get progressively worse. But you know what? By the end of this film, I'll have more to say on Indominus Rexy.
We hear that it'll eventually be 50 feet long when fully grown, and that she's already ready. And of course, they make that distinction too. This isn't a male, this is a female.
Which is what they all were originally.
Yep.
So that's what it should be. Because that made sense.
Exactly.
Yeah. And unintentional or not, that is like proving in a wink way that they've learned nothing.
We get a huge view of the park as the kids make their way through. We're seeing digs and digital renditions of the dinosaurs, Mr. DNA, and basically everything you picture when you think about a dinosaur theme park.
This is the dinosaur theme park. For those that have been, Matt, you've been to Universal since they've done the Dinosaur Center, right?
Oh, yeah. I mean,
okay.
Well, yeah. I've been back when it was just Jurassic Park and they had the Discovery Center from the first movie.
Yep. And to me, that this center, the inside, the kids doing that little fake dig, the screens where you could try to mix DNA. This is that old visitor center when that's all there was. And I love it. I also have a Mr. DNA t-shirt. Fuck you. Dino DNA. So the fact that I go to a theme park and I live this is it's dead on. It's exactly what you get when you go to Universal in Orlando. They don't have this in California.
Yeah, but it's also worth noting that they've kept a lot of the Jurassic Park elements. I mean, the River Adventure, which was converted in California into Jurassic World. has been untouched in Orlando, but they have Velocicoaster, which has the
Raptors.
You know, these characters in it, and you know, like BD Wong, Chris Pratt, Bryce Dallas Howard, they all recorded stuff for the ride. So I like how they blended it. I also didn't catch that Brad Bird is the voice on the monorail.
He is. Mm-hmm. In fact, he was going to be the director of this for a while, and then he pulled out to do that Magnificent Tomorrowland.
Keep it up. We're going to review that.
Well, it seems like every time I turn around, we're doing a series where Brad Bird was involved in somehow. So the kids find Claire, who is completely indifferent to them. She refuses to hug them, refuses to touch them, which was funny. All right, you thought we're going to leave her alone? We're not. We reviewed Bryce Dallas Howard earlier this year in Argyle. Man, none of us really liked her there. This character of Claire took a beating when this movie was out, mostly because of how she runs in her shoes, which we'll get to. Let me get to my feelings on this character. If you guys remember, there was a poster that had her looking at a window and the Indominus Rex pretty much being reflected to her. I think in a weird way, this is kind of a parallelism that they're doing with her and the Indominus Rex, because later on in the movie, Mr. Ani says, I didn't expect it to be white. Well, Claire's wearing white this entire film. I think in a weird way, they are trying to make us think of her as kind of the Indominus Rex, in that she's in her own environment. If you're an Indominus Rex and you're the one thing of your kind, would you want to touch or hang out with anybody? I don't think so. And it lashes out, which Chris Pratt's going to point out later. Here with this character, I see more dimensions of what they're going for, even if it doesn't really come across on screen. That's me kind of reaching. Matt, what do you feel about Claire the character? And Bryce Dallas Howard's performance.
All right, so that's a perspective I've never thought of. That's very well thought out. I wish you wrote this movie, because that's far more interesting than what she's given to do, because she also kind of took a beating because this movie is kind of misogynistic, and I'm going to use that with a capital M, because she never gets a chance to defend herself. Like, she's not a stuck-up bitch. She's not a girl boss, like that type of character that people just hate. She has a very important job. Upkeep is tremendous. She's concerned about revenue, but it's not like she's soulless. But everyone just craps on her constantly. This might as well be a German Schatz film with the amount of verbal defecation that they put on Claire. A lot of it, I think, is unwarranted. And there's a line later on that her sister says that I think is like the most backhanded sexist thing I've heard since that patriarchy line in The Exorcist Legacy or whatever the fuck that was called. And of course, the real SJW, Joss Whedon, had to go out and run his mouth at this time, calling this misogynistic, considering what he had just done in Age of Ultron. I think that's utter hypocrisy for him to say, but, you know, he hides behind feminism nowadays, like Captain America uses a shield, so I shouldn't be all that surprised, fucking hypocrite. But I think Howard's fine. I'm not going to say she's miscast. I don't think the character's written particularly well, and I also don't think the movie gives her any opportunity to stand up for herself.
Well, it's weird because she's not the Hammond. You know, everyone thought that since she's dressed in all white like Hammond was, she's the Hammond of this. She's not. Miss Ronnie is the Hammond. He's the independent contractor who is funding this thing. She's just been hired to run it and make it run successfully. And at that, she's good at her job. And you're right, they don't give any dimensions to her besides that. And I do think it's a detriment to this character, for sure.
Yeah, and the kids are all pissed off. I'd be like, thank you, Aunt Claire. We got unlimited passes and can do whatever we want. It's not like she left them completely alone. And she even tells them, like, I promise I will be there tonight, like, after whatever. But I also appreciate the movie. They hint early on that the parents are getting divorced. I think the way that's dropped in this movie later on is absurd, quite frankly. But that's them, I think, trying too hard to use that Amblin brand as a checklist of things to include.
I can see that. That's a good point.
I wish I had the original version of that poster where they didn't have to Photoshop out her shapely backside.
I went on this whole thing about women's suffrage.
I know. This is the one who craps on Whedon every chance he gets, and he says that.
I appreciate her curves. I don't need to minimize her in any way like they did for that poster. I think she's good. To both of your points, I don't think they write the character in a way that even befits what they're saying the character is. She runs the park. That's her park. Even Mizraki, like, he's the money. Okay, yeah, she runs the park. But instead, she goes to people and tells them they're going to do it. And then it feels like they're agreeing and that suddenly they get the power to decide what they're going to do. A few lines being different where she controls Grady to make sure that he's got to go do it. But everybody that she comes in contact with, they suddenly take urgency away from her. And that's a shame. Like, I think she does a fine job. I think she's a good choice for the role. The shoes, it's amazing that that's the press that this thing fucking gets, because there's amazing shots in this thing later on. But yeah, that they let her be undercut by every male figure that she comes in contact with is pretty damn shitty.
It's like the opposite of mansplaining.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know what you call it, but it's that thing that, like, this is the opposite of Helena and Dial of Destiny. I don't think she's done any favors in this, and it's unfortunate. Although I will say, I don't like any of the characters in this movie outside of, like, one or two.
I was going to get to that. Yeah, there are so many characters in this, and they are all new characters with the exception of one who has, what, maybe four scenes in this entire thing. One very important.
And he thought he was still playing Hugo Strange from Gotham.
Yeah.
Damn it!
I like the way they write her, though, in that how she handles the kids. Because if you notice, she passes these kids off to her assistant, and they also have no human contact. How are they being taken everywhere? They go on a tram. They go on a boat. We're going to see them in a gyrosphere later, which gets them in danger. Like, there is no human contact whatsoever, including with her own nephews. So I like that dimension as well. But to your point, Matt, there is no character here, including one we're going to meet here in a minute, that I give two shits about. So Claire says that she can take the kids into the control room tomorrow and that she'll see them tonight at either 6 or 8 as she hands them off to her assistant. We're hearing that 6 kids are in Lost and Found and that we have this guy who's wearing this shirt that pays tribute to the first park, which he got off eBay. I think if anybody in this movie is kind of like a written representation of the fans of that first movie, I think this is that character.
Oh yeah, he's on a message board.
Yes. About it. We're hearing that corporations are the ones naming the dinosaurs. And he thinks of it as a living system. And then we see a helicopter fly into the park as Clara gets on with Mr. Misrani, who asks to see the new dinosaur. Now, I like this Misrani character. Another character, I wish there was more dimension to him. This guy, Matt, do you remember he was in Life of Pi? I believe he was in Slumdog Millionaire too, wasn't he?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure he was.
Yeah.
I think he was the cop, I think.
Yeah, great actor. But another guy, I wish they gave him more to do. He's the one who funds this thing, but that's pretty much it.
Yeah, he's here to be to explain, like, the benefactor, because there's no Hammond legacy or, like, bloodline. Like, she's not his daughter running the park, which I thought is what they were going to do. That would have been incredibly lazy. But I also like the idea of, like, an Indian mogul buying an American theme park.
Yeah,
I
think who owns Budweiser now? Who owns, like, everything? Who owns U.S. Steel?
Well, it's a great representation to the way the movie business was going too, right? Because, Adam, you talk about this all the fucking time. What do these movies cater to anymore? It's not American audiences. It's foreign audiences. And that's who is running this park as well, or is funding it at least.
Mm-hmm.
So Miss Ronnie says that... Am I reading too much into this script? I have a lot of dementia. Okay. I can't believe I had this much dimension to this plot summary. So Miss Ronnie says that the key to a happy life is to realize that you're never in full control. He says that Hammond never really mentioned profits, and Jurassic World exists to remind them of how small the world actually is.
That's calling Trevorrow when he goes into a meeting
no
halfway
shit.
Through this film.
Now he's sitting at a bar somewhere just going, oh, I remember when I was going to make a Star Wars movie.
Well, we kind of did.
Don't you, Ryan Johnson?
They land as Claire says that they plan to open the new portion of the park in May, but they've run into a few speed bumps. We see that the Indominus Rex tried breaking the glass, and we're hearing it in the trees, but not really seeing it. Miss Ronnie says that this won't give kids nightmares, but it will give nightmares to their parents. We hear that the Indominus Rex also ate her sibling. And this is when we hear of an American Navy man here, and Miss Ronnie insists that he be given a look, as maybe he can see things that they can't. And this is when we're introduced to Owen, played by Chris Pratt. Now, we're going to eventually get to this movie, so I'm not going to say my piece on it yet, but I am a known non-fan of the Guardians of the Galaxy films. Chris Pratt, as you mentioned, Matt, was a huge thing after that movie had come out, and this was his next project. You know, I want to say something I was not expecting to say in this podcast. I like him in this movie. It doesn't happen right away. It takes a while. There's a turning point for that character, which I'll talk about when we get to it. But I do like this character of Owen and the way he's integrated here.
I will break some of that early. I like him here more than I do in Guardians of the Galaxy 1.
Wow.
Though I have a problem every time that I got to watch anybody on screen look like they have a dip in their lower lip the whole fucking time. Something about that bottom lip sticking out with fucking just a dip in there bugs me. But I think this is kind of that action role that he needed to have to break out even more than a superhero film. You know, this, I think, changed it a bit. Then he got things like Terminal List. He's got that really crappy, oh God, Amazon movie where they go back in time to fight aliens.
The Tomorrow War.
He looks like he's dressed like he is the second half of this film. This was damn good casting, though. And this movie was sold as much on him as it was bringing dinosaurs back. Because the trailers, the posters, him riding with raptors on that motorcycle. I mean, that shit, that hit, obviously.
I'm sort of in lockstep with Adam, where I actually like him here more than I did in the first Guardians. I also appreciate that he's not written to be as smarmy as I thought he would be. Because I thought they were just going to rinse and repeat that character. But when he actually has comments, some of them were actually genuinely very funny. There's a line he has later on where he's like, I was in the Navy, not the Navajo, which he's explaining about tracking.
Oh, that was
kids.
A great line. Yeah.
And I think, I don't know what it is about Chris Pratt. Clearly he's got charisma, but I can't not see Andy from Parks and Rec, even though he's like jacked beyond belief now. Like back then where he was just the ultimate man child. But, you know, I think he's fine. I remember when Josh Brolin was going to play this part, I kind of would have liked to have seen that.
Mm-hmm.
Mostly because I don't like the forced romance.
Oh, God.
So, Brolin would be old enough to be Claire's father. That would
I mean, look, but they would not have taken it in that way if they cast him. So that's kind of why I would have preferred that. But he's good. I was surprised because I expected to go back to this and just see Peter Quill.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, when I was going back to watch this part, I thought I was going to like him less than I do when he shows up. And he starts out as a douchebag, but it goes away pretty quick.
And of course, we get this famous scene of him wrangling these raptors. And guys, I have forgotten that Vincent D'Onofrio is here. But here he is playing Hoskins, who is really the voice that I think of when I think of those previous scripts of these raptors actually being part of the U.S. Navy and Army, of the military force. I had completely forgotten about this character.
Yeah, we got two of the Magnificent Seven.
Yes.
You know, I love Vincent D'Onofrio. I mean, this came out the same year as Daredevil. So I was like, I want this guy in everything. I've always liked Vincent D'Onofrio. I do think he's a bit too hammy for this. I mean, he might as well, you know, have some nachos because there's so much cheese in this performance.
Hammy.
But that's also part of my problem. I feel like everyone is all over the place where I think he's too borderline megalomaniac. He might as well be George C. Scott from Dr. Strangelove with the amount of like warmongering he's talking about with these raptors. And then you have other people who, I will say, I think him and Pratt are the most believable when it comes to them interacting with the dinosaurs. I have that suspension of disbelief when they are playing against the raptors. And there's other characters I don't feel that with.
Well, what I'll say about Hoskins is, you say he's warmongering. What he's saying is these dinosaurs deserve more purpose than to be here with $7 sodas. So he is making some good points, but you're right. I always feel like he's one troll of a mustache away from being the film's main villain.
That guy also has Christian Bale syndrome, where he puts on weight and takes it off like it's nothing.
Yeah.
I think D'Onofrio thinks he's in a different movie. He's not bad. He's just, his interactions are a different tone. And I think it just doesn't go great. I do agree that I think him and Pratt kind of have the most naturalistic feel. I believe that there's history there, that they know each other. And I'd almost rather know that I was getting a sequel with maybe that character getting off the island with the dinos and Pratt having to get him back. I think that's something I would have liked to see for a future movie, but spoiler, we don't. He's good, but he's... I remember when he showed up, I'm like, how the... Vincent D'Onofrio, what the hell?
Yeah.
It was just one of those random pulls that you don't expect to see show up.
But it also merkins the waters with how this park operates because he runs InGen security, but InGen doesn't own the park.
Yeah, that's a weird dynamic.
Like, I don't understand how this works with Hammond out of the picture.
Yeah, and you could have solved it with at least a couple lines about, you know, how your funding was coming from different sources, and this is part of how business works. And I think that would have been a perfect play into, you know, the studio system as well, but they don't do that.
So Hoskins is really trying to convince Owen that these raptors are better than drones and their loyalty can't be bought.
Before we go on, I gotta say, this introduction of the raptors, watching them being done this way, feeding them, doing tricks, this is an inspired choice. Because we got to remember what these raptors were in those first three films. And they sure as heck were not someone that you played around with. This, to decide that you're going to do this with kind of your villains of the first trilogy, that takes some nerve. And you got to really know that you're going to sell these velociraptors now to be plushes that kids are going to buy. And I think they do that. And it's kind of amazing that they pulled off that magic trick.
Well, all they had to do was enroll them in gymnastic classes and they would have been fine.
And they
as the Lost World established.
I prefer to never go back to that. So Owen says that Hoskins is making it think that he owns them and he doesn't know what he's dealing with. And Hoskins says that these raptors can replace thousands of boots on the ground and they don't belong in a place where you charge $7 a soda.
It's more like 12, by the way.
Yeah. Maybe in 2015.
If you want the refillable.
Mm-hmm. We see a worker fall, and of course, Owen does his thing. He's looking like a Jedi as he wangles these raptors away.
So apparently all Tib and Lexi had to do in the first movie was just hold their fist up, and they would have been fine.
He asks the new guy if he's wondering why there's a job opening. This was a little too convenient for my taste, but I guess we had to see Owen in action.
Yeah, we also have to reinforce that, hey, these are bloodthirsty animals.
Exactly. We cut back to the park as we see kids riding dinosaurs like ponies, and these kids are looking at this park and wonder, like so many did when that first film was in theaters in 1993. And, you know, I didn't even mention at the top of this, but Trevorrow is making a follow-up to that first film, but it seems like he's trying to ignore those other two sequels, which is a ballsy move considering who's producing this fucking thing.
It is, but I like that he pulled out little things like this, because I guess this was something Spielberg wanted in the first one, but they couldn't do it.
Correct.
So I think that's a loving tribute.
Their mom calls and scolds them for not calling when they landed, and then gets even more angry when she finds out that Claire is even with them. So she calls Claire, crying that she just left the kids, and of course Claire is driving while wearing all white and talking on the phone, representing the successful woman.
Yeah, and then she goes, oh, if you had kids, you'll understand. I was like, oh, apparently you need to have kids in order to have any sense of validity as a woman. Oh, boy, that's a bad line.
Yeah, that is.
Yep.
Claire walks over to Owen and asks him to come look at the Indominus Rex. She says it opens in 3 weeks and they need him to consult and evaluate the Indominus for vulnerabilities. Owen's attempts at flirting, mentioning that they had never had a second date. So of course these two have a history.
Mm-hmm. And it's could be removed entirely, and I think the movie would actually benefit from it.
Completely agree. And you get this talk and it's like, gee, I wonder if they get together at the end. Owen says that even while they were made in a test tube, these dinosaurs still rely on their instinct to eat. And she replies with, you might want to change your shirt because they're sensitive to smell.
I'm also on his side, by the way. If I was living in Central America, you're damn right I would wear board shorts to a date.
Oh, boy. And then we get Bruce the shark being eaten by this Mosasaurus. And I gotta say, man, when this was in the trailers, it really got people excited for this. Nice little joke here aimed right at a movie that the three of us are going to review later this year. But I like this introduction to the Mosasaurus.
What movie is that? not only do I like this. I like the thought process of the amusement park part of this. Mm-hmm. You know, that they have these giant bleachers and then they, you know, they're mechanized. So they drop down and see it under. There's more thought of what a theme park would be. And this is kind of fucking true. Like, this is exactly what it would be like. And I like that. It is... It's thoughtful in that regard. I mean, this goes almost to a Westworld type of thought, which is perfect considering the source material. And, Yeah, I dig it. And this entire scene is just, I mean, it's a splash zone at a theme park. Mm-hmm. It's fucking perfect.
This is Shamu.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I was wondering how you guys were going to take this, because I haven't been to a theme park in 8 years, and you guys seem to go like twice a year. I was wondering how you guys were going to take the theme park version of this. But Adam, you're saying you really dig this.
I do, quite a bit. And in fact, the remake of the Jurassic Park ride here in Hollywood, part of it, when you go in, you go, your boat is going in the Mosasaurus water tank, and it's hitting the glass and spraying you as it goes through. So it's this is just, yeah, something about this theme. Look, you open Jurassic Park, Jurassic World today, and I'm online trying to find a vacation package. You know, so I'm that sucker that's still going to show up.
He would smuggle his tickets in a Barbasol can just to sneak in the park.
Matt, how do you feel about the theme park portions of this?
I thought this was actually neat because SeaWorld has become, because that's where my brain went, it has become much more of a theme park over the last decade than I ever thought possible with the amount of roller coasters they're adding and exhibits. Like, it is much more of a fully functioning Disney-esque park than it ever been. So that evolution starting here, I mean, the fact that they're literally, it's a dolphin whale show. Although a lot of murder, this park openly endorses murder a lot. I'm sure PETA, I want to know what the PETA negotiations were like when they opened this park, because they're eating sharks, they're dropping whole cow carcasses.
So the kids are, once again, every time they shoot these kids, everyone's just loving this. And I do like how when this thing falls, I mean, you guys mentioned Shamu. Man, that's a big splash when this fucking dinosaur hits the water.
I got to say, though, I'm glad the kids are going through this park because we get to see the theme park. I fucking hate these kids. I don't find there's anything likable for either of these two. From trying to give one the obvious autism without being fucking outright about it to the teenage douche bro brother, it's just, these kids are fucking insufferable, and they're supposed to be my like eyes through the park. Let them die. I fucking throw them into the Mosasaurus. These is just as bad as Claire is written. These two have got to be written worse. Oh fuck these kids.
Yeah, I don't blame Garrett, her for these kids off.
I go back to Garrett in the first Jurassic Park. Fuck these kids.
I'm not going to go that far. What I will say is they attempt an arc with these two. By the end, you know, they're saying we're always going to be brothers and nothing's going to ever change that. But to your point about the older kid. So when we meet him, he's saying goodbye to his girlfriend and their dad is like, okay, you're not going off to war. But throughout the course of this, we're seeing him just glare really creepily at every fucking chick on every ride that they go on, which makes me think that maybe, again, I might be giving the screenwriters way too much credit, but maybe the screenwriters are going for, is this why their kid's parents are getting divorced? Their father has a wandering eye. Every time we turn around, this kid's looking at a new chick, and they don't even really define what exactly that is, except that he's leering at these chicks. So it's really weird, that dynamic. And I'm with you guys. Look, I never said kill the kids. I just, in that first film, I just said I did not like the fact that I never felt they were really in danger of being killed. Here, I'm not as strong against killing them, but the arc doesn't really justify them being here.
I'm laughing because you sound like Batman saying, I won't kill you, but I don't have to save you. I'm also confused. Like, they don't act like full siblings. They act like they're stepbrothers, which would make a lot more sense that they're so like abrasive and far enough in age, and one clearly looks like one parent versus the other. So if they went with that, maybe I would have given this some leeway. But yeah, the older brother's a poonhound, and this other kid makes Ralph Wiggum look like a member of Mensa. It's not, I know both these kids are really good actors. That's the thing. Yeah. So I don't blame them, because I saw the older brother was in a movie called Kings of Summer that I liked a lot. Mm-hmm. And the younger kid was in Insidious and Iron Man 3. He was in The Whale, which I didn't realize that was him. But they're the worst when it comes to acting against the dinosaurs. They don't look scared whatsoever.
Oh, man, when they're in that gyrosphere, I believe them. I think they are.
I don't have that, like, visceral reaction like I did with the T-Rex in the first one. Like, I think that's one of those moments that you can't replicate, and it was foolish to try.
Well, that was going to be in my rundown of the film, and I'll get to that when we get to our summarizations at the end. But I have things to say about that as well. So Claire explains how they need something new every year, and the Indominus Rex keeps them relevant.
Although if you work at Disney, it's like every 5 years. Then they just, like, they just bombard you with shit, and once get it done, and then you have to wait another 5 years.
Owen walks in as Claire is still in all business mode. He says that animals need to develop trust, and the only relationship this dinosaur has is on that crane. And again, I am going with this. I think these are all ideas that Crichton had, but Spielberg just really didn't. He was really more in love with the wonder of the first Jurassic Park as opposed to the science of it. But they're trying to explain more of the science.
And I think it makes sense. You know, you have an antisocial dinosaur because it's never socialized. Mm-hmm. And that makes sense to me. You know, I think the gene splicing could have done a little more of that as well. You know, you get a little bit here and there, I think, just because they need to justify some shit. But I think it makes sense. I don't know if Owen is the right person to break that out, to be honest, but it makes good sense with what they're doing.
We see that the electric doors and gates have been turned off and that this Indominus Rex has an implant on her back, so Claire leaves to track it. Claire takes off as Owen does a search for the Indominus Rex. Of course, it's a female, so it's very angry. Claire, sorry.
Well, also just because you can't recognize a heat signature, I still would not go into the paddock.
Yeah.
This movie has my problem that I bitch about a lot, where people just do dumb things because the script requires them to.
Claire is being told that the Rex is in its cage and Owen is there. The Rex steps out of the shadows and we hear the crunching of one worker getting eaten. Owen runs away and hides under a car. A little suspenseful moment here, kind of reminiscent of the kids in the car from the first film, as another worker gets eaten and Owen just douses himself with gasoline, which is apparently dino repellent. Kind of an Indiana Jones moment here.
Huge. The way he's sliding and rolling, he did, you know, thank God he doesn't have a hat to, you know, to try to get. But I like the little nods also of, you know, the dude trying to sit there and be quiet, reminding me of the lawyer in the original Jurassic Park, and then just that head coming down and, you know, but I mean, we are only 35 minutes into this, and suddenly this thing is on. Because now the dino's loose, you know, we're a quarter into the film, and it's already breakout time.
Couldn't have come fast enough, because I could have done without all the family drama nonsense, which by the way, I feel like they're only related to Claire because that's a beat from the first one of being Hammond's grandkids adds a sense of urgency. And they're trying to replicate. They're trying to replicate that exact beat here.
Well, here's the
I feel real... that's there for that. And I feel the divorce is there because of Amblin, but it doesn't fit. Like, I think they're trying to do nods, but it comes across really sloppy.
Well, here's the real question. The real question is, did we care about the humans in the previous films?
Care and like are two different words. I liked them, but I didn't necessarily care about them. This, I don't really feel either. I mean, I like Owen as a person, but I feel like he's just the gene splice. He's Malcolm, Grant, and the Ranger from the first movie all merged into one character.
The original Jurassic Park, the family dynamic kind of worked for me because I felt that with Grant. I felt that with Laura Dern's character. Sorry, I can't remember the name. But also, there's that moment, and maybe it's just because of how good of an actor he is, but when Hammond's just like, those are my grandkids out there, I believe that. Well, Judy Greer's on the other side of the world, and Claire's not given that kind of drama to bring out of this. So, fuck them kids.
She should have called Judy Greer and said they're in the danger zone and just winked.
Claire walks into the control room and tells everyone to remain calm. Masrani says that this was inevitable. One of them was going to get out eventually. And then we're told that raptors can run 40 miles per hour, sometimes 50 if they're running after prey. Vic talks about how he hunted a wolf pup as a kid and he had an unshakable bond with it. And this is when Vic also hears of code 19 and he sees it as an opportunity.
Yeah, 2319.
Yeah.
Monsters Inc. What they should have is, because I wish this movie was a bit, you know, it's satirical, but I wish it was a little bit more comedic. Like, they should have had the thing of like how many days without an incident and the guy has to flip it back to zero and he just rolls his eyes. Like, oh shit, well, this day was gonna come.
We cut to dinos running as the kids are now up in the sky bus. Owen confronts Claire about how this highly intelligent animal is now on the loose. He says that they are going after the dinosaur with non-lethals, and they see that she has clawed out her tracking device. And these workers, this reminded me of Aliens. They're taken out left and right. In another nice little scene, these guys are just, they just don't have a chance. And of course, we're seeing the heat vision and everything just kind of rolled into this. This reminded me of Aliens. And of course, this movie opened with a cracking egg. So those comparisons are going to come.
Yeah, and I do appreciate that this is not a bloodless movie, which I really thought it was going to be. Because you see, like, droppings and not those kind of droppings, but you see, like, blood on the trees and there's splatters when dinosaurs attack people. So it doesn't feel as toothless as I thought it was going to be. But I also think, wow, you guys really should have upped your security because you guys all suck.
Yeah.
Like, they get taken out really easily.
They did. And I'm with you. I think they pushed this PG-13 rating to its absolute highest depth because I do feel that this is just on the cusp of being an R. I think they use that really well.
Yeah, for the record, the number 13 is, I think, the IQ of most of the park goers in this movie.
If this ain't great. I mean, when they're hunting it down, I like that it doesn't. We're focused on the Indominus, right? But we see other dinosaurs the whole time this is going on. Mm-hmm. You got a Stegosaurus, one of my top three. We should discuss top favorite dinosaurs more often as an adult, you know, because. Let's do it. But you got a Stegosaurus here, you know, drinking at the water while these guys are going through, about to be Indominus fodder. But I like this scene a lot. But yeah, the weapons, the monitors that they got on screens back at base, it's an obvious alien. But when this thing uncamos itself, and fuck, I mean, it's a full-blown monster scene that you get showing up here. And it's pretty damn good.
Yeah, I mean, does this thing have Predator DNA too?
I know, I was thinking that too.
Although, they should have called it the Indominus Rex. To be perfectly honest, because this thing can outsmart everybody, and it can get wherever it needs to whenever the plot requires it to.
Mm-hmm.
Like, this thing might as well be part Nightcrawler, because it teleports all the way across the goddamn park like it's nothing.
Owen says to evacuate the island, and Claire responds with, "They will never reopen if we do that." This is Brody warning people in the in Jaws about the shark, right, Matt?
I mean, No. This is Jaws 2 and 3,
yeah.
Because... it's happened before, and it takes place at a theme park.
Yes.
He does kind of look like Dennis Quaid.
Yeah, he does. Oh, I can't wait to talk about Jaws 3. God, do I have things to say. Claire calls for a Phase 1 real world, and Zach is caught staring at Broads as the gyrosphere pulls up. Of course.
Sorry. I need to ask this question. Now, yes. Obviously, we've all gone through puberty, and I am more akin to the same sex versus you two. I don't remember ever being this much of a poonhead where I'm just staring at anything with a pulse.
Let me tell you, me and my friends went to Great America one time just so that we could stand at the end of the water ride and look at chicks as they walked off the ride. So
I stand corrected. Wow. I feel like I'm in the middle of a Weinstein audition with you two just talking about this movie.
That was about 25, 30 years ago. But yeah, I got to say, I'm just as guilty. Of course, it is right after they and Adam's just quiet because I know he has worse stories probably.
The other friend?
Yeah.
That's why look...
No, he wasn't with me.
Hey, those girls are staring back.
Yeah, but they look at him the way women look at Peter Parker in Spider-Man 3.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's a good call. Of course, it is right after these kids leave that the operator gets the call to close down the ride. And he's just like, I just work here, man. Like, why are you guys yelling at me? Oh, these poor fucking theme ride workers.
To be fair, I'm sure University experiences that anytime Battle at the Ministry breaks down.
And we get Dr. Wu talking to Masrani, and he tells him of the addition of Cuttlefish Strand, which, by the way, guys, this is the second time this summer of 2015 that the Cuttlefish is mentioned in a summer movie. You guys remember?
Age of Ultron? Andy Serkis in Age of Ultron.
Andy Serkis.
Pretty remarkable. Wu is also warning of the predatory traits that these animals have. He says that nothing in Jurassic World is natural, and they're just used to being the cat in the wild as opposed to a canary.
I like his line when he says, like, none of this is... natural, like we spliced frog DNA in the first movie, so we're still technically playing by the playbook that they left.
One of my favorite talking scenes of the movie actually is this one right here between these two.
Yeah, which is weird. Normally, I don't like a lot of the talking in this movie.
Yeah, same here. But I think the writing here is much sharper than we've seen in the past.
Well, in a lot of ways, this movie kind of reminds me, I don't think it's as good, but it's got the Rise of the Planet of the Apes problem, where I like the science behind it and the way they kind of explain their philosophies, but I just don't like the characters.
Yeah, same two writers.
Mm-hmm. What I'd like about it is I think it acknowledges the changes. And one of the things that bugs the living shit out of me are people that think that raptors are like this. People who, like, my top five dinosaurs, number one, Velociraptor. Velociraptor didn't exist. Raptors are the little fucking bird-shaped ones, kind of like in Jurassic Park 2. So to me, it's that kind of acknowledgement that they have changed what people's perceptions of dinosaurs are. And the meta-commentary throughout, I'm a fan of.
Yeah, there are literally videos on YouTube of if Jurassic Park had realistic raptors, and you will laugh your ass off.
Yeah.
Yep.
Did anyone laugh their ass off at this Jimmy Fallon cameo in this gyrosphere?
No, because he already has his own theme park ride at Universal.
Yes.
Both coasts. And that's what he does now, the tour in Hollywood, and he does a full fucking New York ride in Florida.
Which that ride is really good if you are a fan of The Tonight Show, because they recreate the studio. And they have, like, memorabilia. Like, they have Johnny Carson's, like, actual suit you can see. Mm-hmm. And the ride itself is good when you want to get out of the heat. But the trade-off is it will get you sick as you possibly can be if you have any sensitivity to motion sickness.
I have not yet gone on it in all the times we've been to Orlando Universal.
It's good when you want to get out of the heat. because it's like one of the first rides you can walk to.
Yeah.
And they were the smart, because the first two rides are Minions, and those get flooded right away.
They see Stegosauruses. Meanwhile, Claire is looking at what she's created and calls her assistant to get the boys back to the hotel. She then calls Zach and the hamster ball, and the call gets promptly canceled. She's freaking out over the ball being out there by itself and gets so frustrated with her crew that she has to do this by herself. And God, do I know this feeling all too well when your crew fails you and you have to do it all yourself.
My question is about the design of this ride. It's not on a track.
It is until it's out there, and then it's just free to roam.
That was my problem with it. So they can't remotely control them back. They can't force them back. And apparently you can just off. This is just open world. Yeah. Really bad design. Your lawyers would never have let this pass.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, especially given what happened in the first movie.
Exactly. Meanwhile, Claire tells Owen that she needs his help in getting her nephews back. And Owen is shocked that she doesn't know how old they are.
Well, to be fair, they also never say, because mm-hmm. the younger one has to be, what, 10?
At least, yeah.
I don't know how old the kid was at the time, because he's pretty young in Iron Man 3. Mm-hmm. What's funny, he talks more like an adult in that movie than he does in this.
The boys count the dinosauruses, as they call them, and they are promptly attacked by Indominus. I like seeing the dinos fight with one another. That stuff is cool. And if you remember, guys, I didn't mention it, but in the beginning of this, we're introduced to these kids with one of them looking at a viewfinder of these dinosaurs attacking one another and fighting one another. This is the stuff I wanted when I was watching Jurassic Park as a teenager, was seeing dinosaurs fight one another. And I get that. I get that in spades here.
Yeah, that's part of what I want. You know, I want the majesty of just seeing them and everything else. But like the point of this movie, we've moved on. We need bigger, stronger, faster. So to quote the Hulk in one of Marvel's worst movies, big monster.
Viewfinders don't even fucking exist in 2015. No, that's unrealistic. Like the fact that he would have one made me laugh my ass. But I think this was a, they took the cheese and tried to replicate the T-Rex scene.
Claire is still not having any luck reaching the kids, as Zach's phone is out of reach, and Indominus puts a hole in the gyrosphere and tries chomping it. And this was the big scene in 3D, was this scene right here, this fucking claw just going right through this glass, and pretty awesome.
It's funny this came out in 3D, but I went to go see Jurassic Park in 3D when they re-released it, and that had the 3D for that was surprisingly well done.
The boys are out, and they promptly make a run for it. They reach a cliff of water and jump down before they are dino food. This was kind of a thrilling scene.
So my problem again, these dinosaurs can run however fast or slow the plot requires them to.
Yeah.
And they're not wearing heels. In fact, he's wearing Converses, which anybody who has worn them knows they are impossible to run in.
Yeah, I had them.
It's a good little scene. I mean, you know, I wish Indami would have eaten one of them at least, but yeah, it does the job. But again, when you get kids jumping off a cliff, I don't know how they're ever going to get back to where they need to go. I really liked the helicopter scene at the beginning of this film, because I thought that it was giving us kind of a reference of where everything lays out on this island, which I think is always smart, but then it doesn't play by the rules later on.
So they reach the embankment, and Zach is impressed that they jumped. Meanwhile, Owen and Claire, they assess the damage, and Owen sees a fallen dino, much like Laura Dern did in the first one. Owen helps it raise its head before falling down dead. And we have the sadness being conveyed here. But I tell you what this scene does, boys. This, to me, is the moment that Claire's character makes a turn. Because this is when she, if you notice, she's refusing to touch anything, everybody. But here, when she touches this dino and it dies in her arms, this is when she's actually turned into, quote unquote, being human again. And she's actually more concerned about these kids than she was in the beginning.
I don't necessarily like the way that this scene looks, especially when it pans out. I think this is one of the scenes, to Matt's point earlier, where not all the CG is good CG. But when they're there practical in their arms, I think it looks pretty good. And yeah, I think both the characters take a turn for the better.
Am I reading too much into this writing, Matt?
No. I just think this is too schmaltzy for me. Like I almost need to take a shot of insulin to get the sugary sweetness out of my mouth.
Don't forget, this is a Spielberg production.
No, trust me, this drilled it into my fucking head.
They look and see all the dinosaurs that have fallen, and Owen makes the point that Indominus didn't eat them. It's just killing for sport.
I thought Fallen Kingdom was next week.
They find the gyrosphere taken apart and a tooth attached for good measure, but they're relieved to see that the boys did make it out. Claire asks Owen if he can track them, and Owen replies he was with the Navy, not the Navajo, as Matt mentioned earlier. Owen makes his madness known as Claire tries her damnedest to get ready for battle. We cut to Gray and Zach. They're finding remnants of the old Jurassic Park. Okay, so this is when the nostalgia kicks in, right? And Look, three of us
This whole movie is nostalgia.
But the second half of this especially, because we're going to get to T-Rex in the second half of this.
This becomes a J.J. Abrams type of nostalgia.
Well, that's the comparison for sure. But I think what we're doing here, the three of us have discussed so many, and Indiana Jones being the big culprit, and Star Wars to a lesser degree, but that's nostalgia for us, for me and Adam. This stuff is for people in Matt's age range of they saw this when they were kids. This is the nostalgia coming back to them. We're seeing millennial nostalgia here, and I didn't really get that until I watched it for this podcast.
It's there, but one of the reasons it doesn't work, you know, I can only speak for myself personally. I'm not high on the first Jurassic Park movie.
Yeah.
But I will say I got that feeling going to Universal. I can't lie. Like, when you're in it, as authentic as it could possibly be, like it'll make you feel all warm and fuzzy inside, even if you're a hardcore cynic like me. So I feel like I'm not the right audience to get that type of response. I do like that everything looks appropriately run down, except for one thing, which we'll talk about.
Oh, God. Yeah. I completely agree with you, Matt. I completely agree with the fact that if you were not huge on that first film, this isn't going to work as well for you. And the two of us were definitely not huge on that. But Matt, Adam, you were pretty big on that first film. How do you feel about the way the first film's integrated here?
I think it's funny because I wrote on here, on my notes, I'm like, this is the scene that's going to cause a fight. What I like about it is it doesn't insult what came before. If you haven't seen it, also, it doesn't really matter because it broke down that there was a prior park. I can't remember if I knew before this scene on the first watch that it was the same island, but I think this is necessary to let you know exactly where they are. And I think this is how you integrate the past properly. I could understand why people would be bugged by it, but to me, this is the kind of member berries that make sense.
So they explore as the old theme echoes in the background. Gray finds the goggles and the 1992 Jeep, and Zach brings up the idea of fixing it up because these two apparently can fix up Jeeps.
Yeah, their relationship is defined by exposition. Hey, remember when we did this? And okay, I could buy him being able to jumpstart a car, but these Jeeps have not run for 20 fucking years.
Yes.
And it starts up no problem.
I know.
I believe dinosaurs being recreated more than I believe that.
During COVID, when my car wasn't running for 3 months, I had trouble starting it. I couldn't imagine it starting after 20 fucking years.
Yeah. If you don't drive your car like 3 days after a snowstorm, you have trouble getting it. Add the fact that it's the humidity, dust, natural buildup of grease. This was the most ridiculous thing in the movie. And I was trying to think, like, what could happen in this scene that would make me laugh my ass off? And I thought, like, a blind Dennis Nedry being there.
Oh, jeez.
I was like, because I'm like, okay, why are we going to this spot outside of just, hey, remember this? There has to be like something plot-wise that they stumble upon, and that would have made me laugh. Or they found like the actual Barbasol can that they were looking for all these years, but they have no clue what's in it. But it's just, hey, remember this part, and we need this to get away from the dinosaurs so we can hit you with the Jeeps that you've probably bought merchandise of at some point in your life.
Mm-hmm. So Hoskins comes in and confronts Misrani, telling him that he needs to greenlight a project to get the raptors to hunt and kill Indominus. They then hop on a helicopter and take off. Meanwhile, we cut to Zach and Gray as they're putting the Jeep back together, get it working. And Zach, if you fail part of a driving test, you fail the actual driving test. That seems to be one of the themes of this movie is if you don't finish driving school like Misrani and the helicopter or fail a driving test like Zach, you can still do until you do it right. Meanwhile, Claire and Owen, they get trapped against an original Jurassic Park Jeep by Indominus. It attacks as they run away. They chase Indominus until it's in the pterodactyl, quote-unquote, pterodon pen. So, of course, they get out and the helicopter crashes, killing Misrani. I was shocked that they killed Misrani here. I did not think they would do that.
God, this was so stupid.
Why?
Indominus Rex in their sight with a chain gun. They can't bring it down. It bursts through the aviary like the goddamn Kool-Aid man. The pteranodons come out. Take out the helicopter. I was laughing uncontrollably watching this last night on my couch. Because from here on out, for the next like 15 minutes, this becomes hilarious pandemonium.
You know what? That's what the warning was of Jurassic Park. So the fact that we're actually getting escaped dinosaurs on the loose, I think that's kind of the cool part about this.
Oh, this next 15 minutes is my favorite part of the movie.
Mm-hmm.
This thing turns into just full-blown action mayhem. I was not expecting them to kill Ms. Ronnie. I think that's a choice. Still blows me away, actually. Yeah. But I do think it works as a oh shit moment, as an escalation when that helicopter crashes through and all those pterodons are released. It's just to me, it's that escalation factor.
We saw these pterodactyls in part three. If you remember, we saw it in Fog and Darkness, so we didn't really get clear pictures of them because they couldn't really do too many of them back in 2001. Here they are. They're much more lit. They're in plain sunlight, and I'll go on a limb and say this is probably my favorite stuff of the film. All these scenes involving these pterodactyls, pterodons, are pretty great, including a kill we'll talk about here in a bit.
I'm okay with it. I don't know. For some reason, aviary dinos just, they don't hold the same level of magic as other ones do for me. So I think it's okay. But it doesn't do as much as when I get a really cool land monster going through. I'm still waiting for my ankylosaurus scene.
You got it. They tried to fight the Indominus Rex and failed.
It was a quick, it didn't work. Poor babe.
Well, we're learning so much about Adam's prejudices.
I know. Matt, you said
this. I also don't understand, like, maybe it's just the effects, but why do some of them look like they have baby T-Rex heads? Like, did they forget what kind of dinosaurs they were rendering? Or was this part of their gene splicing thing of, oh, let's mix a pteranodon and a raptor, see what happens?
I guess you could fall back on that. I don't know. I didn't pay too much attention to that, but I think they look cool. I like when they swarm the park. I like seeing the overhead shots of them. So there's a public announcement for all guests to take shelter as the pterodons attack. Hoskins checks out the carnage from above as Zara, the assistant, is taken underwater by the pterodons, and then she's eaten by the Massasaurus. Again, we're keeping the Massasaurus in our back of our heads. We saw it earlier. We're seeing it eat here. We're going to see it again at the end. But this for sure is the most intense death of the movie. I thought this stuff was pretty great, actually. Matt, you saying this is your favorite part?
Not necessarily. I was talking more about just the pandemonium in general, but why did they give her such a cruel death? She did like nothing wrong outside of lose the kids, but they ditched her. This is the kind of death you save for your villain.
I don't know. I found the fact that it was her to be the unpredictable part that I liked. I liked the fact that it was her or it was anybody. I've been calling for these movies to get intense like this for four straight films, and I actually finally get one here. So I was with it.
This entire pandemonium down Main Street without it being Main Street, because that would be the other park.
It's City Walk, right down to Starbucks, Ben and Jerry's, and Margaritaville, all of which you can go to at Orlando City Walk.
Yes, you can.
We even get a Jimmy Buffett cameo here, too.
No, but that's my favorite part, where everything's going to shit, the guy still grabs the margaritas and walks inside. I laugh my ass off, because that's $40 right there you're leaving on the table.
We eat at Margaritaville every time we go. Right outside his plane. This is great, because this is, I don't know, something about that meta commentary, again, with just the consumerism and theme park and this, to me, which has been more Disney than Universal, at least inside the theme park, that suddenly every store is a brand, you know, and I'm sure that Pandora and everybody else paid fucking half this film's budget with the way that it's there. But even IMAX has got its own theme. Remember when you go to a theme park and you would get the IMAX special movie, which was great because it was real IMAX, you know, like the space station 3D and some of that really cool shit.
A deep blue sea, not that deep blue sea, but there was like a water one.
Yeah.
Like that used to be some of my favorite stuff, going to a theme park, because I was that fun kid. But yeah, I like this. And I like her death because it was so unpredictable. I can still remember everybody just being like, oh, shit, it is mean. It is completely mean-spirited. She didn't deserve it, and it's awesome. And I didn't realize until this watch, it's a subtle little way to remind us that Mosasaurus exists.
Yeah, I like the fact that she's picked up right in front of the IMAX screen that's showing what? Pterodons. Just nice little meta stuff there. Claire and Owen, they find the kids as Claire takes out a pterodon with her little gun and then proceeds to kiss Owen, which came out of fucking nowhere. She proceeds to tell the kids that Owen is just someone she works with. We then see Hoskins relieve all the control center people of their duties, which Owen overhears. The kids ask if they can stay with Owen as Hoskins fucks with the caged raptor. Smart move there, sir. I wonder what's going
to
happen.
This also makes no sense. Like, now Engine is next in line to run the park.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's just some guy walking into, I mean, God, this isn't the fucking White House 2025 where somebody just walks in and says something, so you have to follow it.
Yeah, like, why isn't Wu in charge?
Yeah.
If he's, like, main geneticist, or Claire. Mm-hmm. I know she's not there, but, like, why does it immediately go to, like, DEFCON 10 and InGen steps in?
Yeah, there's a structure. That nobody says, who the fuck are you?
Owen arrives and belts Hoskins as they set up a plan to use the raptors as weapons. Owen tells the kids the names of the raptors as Claire sends the kids to the back of a mini truck. And here comes another money shot from the trailer, right, guys? Of Chris Pratt riding side by side next to these raptors.
Oh, yeah, this was the poster.
Yeah. Here's the thing, like, I like this, but at the same time, how quick does Owen turn to Hoskins' way of thinking of, oh yeah, they're my raptors, they're my animals, but I'll go ahead and use them. I'll go ahead and go with you on this plan. This is a little too quick turnaround for me.
Agreed.
Trevorrow is using some good camera work here, as in some shots they're running on par with the camera itself, which, again, some good camera work being done here. Good filmmaking. Zach tells Claire that her boyfriend's a badass as Hoskins makes sure the equipment is recording, and this is when she turns. This is when she turns and she's like, okay, I really like you.
Now it's like freaking Fast and Furious.
The team arrives as Claire closes the window. And Indominus shows up, and they have a slight conversation while Owen says the reason no one told them what the Indominus Rex was made out of is because it's part raptor. So we're waiting this long.
And none of you numbnuts can figure that out.
Oh my God, this was enraging to me. We keep this just for the reveal here. As you said, Matt, this is just convenient to the plot.
Yeah, we have this in our bag to have some kind of reveal, but it makes everyone look so dumb that this is a surprise.
Oh my
God. Especially Owen, who has been with raptors since they were born. He can't figure out the Indominus Rex. He was right next to it before this.
Enraging.
Doesn't bug me just because the only part that bugs me is that Claire didn't know. Like, she runs the park.
Yeah.
So I don't care about Owen not knowing because he's kept in or out of something depending on convenience. But there's no way that Claire, she signs everything off. Mm-hmm. So whatever. But this moment when they're hunting it down, and then suddenly the raptors turn around, and you realize they've joined the other side. I think it's a pretty fucking cool-ass shot.
When they're communicating with one another, and you get that oh shit moment, I think that's a good reveal, too. I just hate the way it's vocalized in these scenes. The raptors get the upper hand. One looks right at Owen, gives a slight nod as it's taken out by a grenade. We see someone get attacked on the inside of a tree trunk as Owen leads them away. And then we see someone from InGen warn Claire to get away as he puts a bloody hand on her window as the kids electrocute an attacking raptor. So they finally get something to do here.
They said the raptor can run up to 45 miles an hour, but it still can't catch up to them in the back.
Exactly. Owen shows back up and says they need to get indoors. We have Henry Wu back. He tries telling Hoskins that the embryos will be safe here as we see the need to strike out with a girl who has a boyfriend. This was odd. Like, why inject this fucking romantic comedy in the middle of this movie? I feel like these two had a bigger part in this movie and most of it was cut, but we have to have the moment where the guy is trying to give her a hug and she's like, no, I have a boyfriend, or give her a kiss.
Yeah, that's like earlier, there's a line Claire says it's insulting. It's just like mean. Like, it's just that.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's some things cut out that didn't fit right.
We see Wu show up to see Hoskins, as does Owen, Claire, and the kids, but they see that the lab has been evacuated. When they go to explore it, they see various dinos in cages as Hoskins shows up to say Henry Wu now works for InGen. He gives a Bond villain monologue as a raptor arrives in the room. Hoskins tries talking him down, saying he's on their side as a raptor attacks and kills him. From this point on, guys, I mean, we're in a straight horror film.
Oh, this becomes in 5 minutes, this turns into a Royal Rumble. So let's,
okay.
I mean, because there's literally a hot tag.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, I'm not going to call it a horror movie, but it's definitely, I'm not bored anymore. And that was a compliment. And I'm kind of going with it as just dumb shoving popcorn in my mouth and enjoying the eye candy, because I also like the little thing where they play the projection of the Dilophosaurus.
Yeah.
I was like, okay, I was like, that's pretty clever. Mm-hmm. I don't understand how he knows how to work the device, but
I think this second half of this, I mean, it runs. I wish some of the other stuff that was obvious editing choices was done differently, because I think it hurts the pacing of this film. You know, whatever D'Onofrio was supposed to be, I think has changed out. But yeah, to me, this is going, and it's just full-blown monster splash fun.
We see images from the first film, as Matt mentioned, such as the spitting dino as Owen has a conversation with the raptors. He takes the collar off one of them as the good old Indominus shows up, and it whacks a raptor right into a wall. We see a raptor get incinerated as Claire tells Danny to do something right once in his life. And this is the one moment he gets in this movie. He opens the door that has the T-Rex in it. So
this one, but this line, like, this is the one that I mean, where she's just like insults him.
Uh-huh.
It's it doesn't seem fitting for him. For her, it doesn't seem right for him. I don't know. Something's missing. And this is not the film with like an extra 30-minute extended edition out there. So
no, save whatever that for it was, 2 weeks from now.
Yeah, whatever it is missing.
We see that Claire has a flair, much like Malcolm did in the first film. And there was monster applause in the theater I was in. And this is a theater full of critics, by the way, when good old T-Rex shows up here, complete with scars from the first film, which I actually thought was a nice touch.
Oh, you might as well have been at a pay-per-view and heard that breaking glass.
Yeah.
Oh yeah, this was fucking the T-Rex might as well have roared if you smell.
I mean, this was, you know, something a few years later, like with Cap lifting the hammer. I mean, this, everybody just popped huge for this. Because you see the T-Rex earlier, like they set it up, you see it. But the fact that it's the same T-Rex because you see the scars is, I think, a really, really nice touch. And that, again, your villain from the previous film is about to be the hero of this one is an interesting choice that I think works really well.
I should hate this, but I throw out my hands and say, you know what? I'm having fun. It's stupid, but at least I don't feel like I'm being insulted or browbeaten like a Transformers movie, as an example, which those movies also get ridiculous at the end, but it's like an assault on my senses. I kind of want to see, always wanted to see like a full-on dinosaur Royal Rumble, and I feel like that's kind of what this is, and I'm judging it on that context.
You know what? I'm right with you, because the first time I saw this, I rebelled against this. I really couldn't stand this ending. My rating reflected that. Here, I'm exactly like you. I'm having fun, man. This is some of the most fun I've had reviewing a film with you guys this year so far. And I feel like I'm just right in the midst of some pretty good filmmaking, some thrills, some old-style, you know, Jurassic Park-type dino action, and I'm having fun.
It makes me think of Kong Skull Island, where you get some of that battle going on and you realize that, oh yeah, this is kind of what I was missing and that what I came for. And this is put Gorilla Monsoon and Bobby the Brain and let them commentate this shit. Cause I mean, I will say that the CG is not great. It's pretty damn good, but you start to see some scenes, especially when you overlay some of the human characters. But I did not expect that we would get this kind of battle royale, and I'm really glad they chose to go this way.
So the two go at it as Clara's what, crawling around, I guess. She pulls herself up long enough to yell run, and just as Indominus was about to deal the killing blow to the T-Rex, we hear the call of the raptor and they join the fray. A bigger standoff
this shot of blue fucking running through shit.
Oh, the slow motion. I couldn't stop laughing.
A bigger standoff ensues as the Mosasaurus somehow senses the raptors are in trouble and takes Indominus underwater. I don't know. It's easy to think that, okay, they're this close to the water, something's going to happen. But again, another big clapping moment. Everybody was applauding this moment in the theater I was in. This was huge.
Great, because I didn't see it coming. You know, you'd think they're going to take him down. That's going to be it. It goes on long enough that it's a pretty decent fight. It does a job. It's not just one, two shots and it's over. This fight lasts longer than most of Goldberg's fights. And I wasn't expecting the run-in from the Mosasaurus to save the day.
Well, so, the T-Rex is about as old as Goldberg is now. So I'm like, fuck it, you win, movie. Like, I don't even... Like, I'm having fun, and I kind of hate myself because I normally rebel against this type of callbacks and service, but at least they're consistent with the Mosasaurus, and the movie had to end some way, so why not just give me a big, like, Godzilla fight? Because even the Godzilla movies at this time weren't giving me the Godzilla fights that I wanted.
I think that is my bigger take off this ending, is they didn't have an ending. These raptors go back on Owen's side pretty damn quickly, and we just kind of rush to this. That's my one gripe, though, with this ending, is they rush to it, but still, I'm like you, Matt. My arms are up on the couch, and I'm just like, fuck it, I'm having fun. I don't care.
And I think it you know, goes to that old adage, too, though, that there's always a bigger fish. You know, as big as you got raptors, bigger than them, you got the T-Rex, bigger than that, you got Indominus. You forget about the slow-moving, big-ass Mosasaurus.
Was not expecting a Qui-Gon callback. So there's always a bigger fish. So Owen shares a look with one of the raptors as it walks away, as Danny turns off the power to the control room. We cut to people in some kind of shelter recovering from the previous day's events. As the parents of Zach and Gray, they show up to pick them up. Clara asks Owen what they do now, and he responds with stick together for survival purposes. And they walk out of this shelter full of these people in complete pain and bite marks right out into the sunset. We cut to the T-Rex walking and letting out a massive goodbye roar as credits roll on Jurassic World. Matt, do you have anything to say about this ending?
I appreciate that they followed up with the fact that all these people are fucking hurt and they're going to be sued out the ass.
Adam, anything
too to bad say? That lawyer from the first one isn't still alive.
Right.
That would have been funny if he showed up.
Adam, how do you feel about this ending, sir?
I dig it. I think it's a nice fitting end. I think if they were never going to do anything else, and I don't think necessarily they knew they were going to, I think it puts, think about it, your villain of the original film is now triumphant and holding its belt aloft here on that center. It's a pretty cool ending. And again, when that theme swells, it's emotional masturbation, but it gets me.
Yeah, this is the equivalent of like playing Binary Sunset in the new movies for Star Wars. Yeah.
All right, scale of 1 to 10. What do we give Jurassic World? Adam, you go ahead, sir.
For a lot of the discussions we've had around Spielberg films, and we haven't had a whole heck of a lot, but we've done some. And I do consider this a Spielberg film, at least, you know, along the lines. I'm a little harsh for the beard for good reason. I think this takes the DNA of those films and alters it to a way that it needs to for a current audience. You look at something like Westworld, you look at the original film, you look at the series. I think it makes smart changes. I think this not only changed what it needed to for the current type of generation, and I don't mean that insultingly, but I think adding the meta commentary on theme parks, on commercialism, on consumerism, on just who we are, makes this more than just the theme park movie of the first one. And I think it keeps so much of that original Jurassic Park DNA for going the second and third one, some weird ass detours. And I think it does a pretty good job. I think the casting is well done. I think the screenwriting, as opposed to necessarily the story writing, I think the screenwriting is lackluster. I think some of this might have been written day of or night before, and I think it shows. I think Claire has done a disservice with the script. I really like what she brings to it. I like her presence throughout. And even when she, you know, standing up to Owen at one point and changes her look and takes her shirt, untucks it, ties it, and he's like, what the hell is that supposed to be? I'm ready to go. To turn into an old man, I like her moxie throughout this film. This thing does what it needed to do for me, which is make me remember why I liked going to big ass movies in theaters that did not have to have a cape or spandex in it. This is almost a superhero film, but there's something about dinosaurs, man, something about monsters, something about Godzilla and Kong and those type of films when they're done right. I think they're exciting, and I think you can forgive a lot of the mistakes that they make. And the spectacle of this makes me very forgiving of some of the mistakes that are present throughout, because I think there's pacing problems throughout this film, kind of from open to end. I think there's got some pacing problems. But at the end of the day, goddamn, I have a lot of fun. This is a supersized McDonald's fries where, man, they're not good for me, but fuck, it tastes good when I'm having it. I have a lot of fun with this film. My kids, and that's a part of it, you know, watching this with my kids and watching this be their Jurassic trilogy is fucking exciting. This is an 8 on 10. To me, this is, at least at this point, is the second best part of this franchise, and to me, it's not even close. I think it's a worthy successor. If you were just to watch the first one and this back to back, I think you would be happy. 8 on 10 for Jurassic World.
Wow, an 8 from Adam. Matt, what you say, sir?
Well, after a couple of retrospectives where we agreed too much, I'm glad that we finally have some variance in our scores, because I am not as enthusiastic as Adam. Maybe I just hate dinosaurs and I have my own interspecies biases that I carry with me since childhood, but I appreciate the swing. This was not the train wreck that I thought it was going to be going back for the first time in a decade. And I certainly enjoyed my time watching it, but I think the framework here is really good, and the business acumen of looking at this from a more cynical, you know, marketability perspective for the Jurassic franchise is a justifiable reason to make another one. But that's only half of the writing in this movie. The other half is trying to get me invested in characters that, quite frankly, I don't give a shit about. No matter how hard the movie tries, you have a 10-year-old kid who's clearly on the spectrum, but the movie doesn't want to admit it, openly crying about his parents getting divorced, despite them being in, like, his happy place, and we've never seen him have this kind of emotion before. Between that and the Brontosaurus bleeding out like Mickey at the end of Rocky 3, I felt like they were trying too hard. And in other parts, I felt like they weren't trying at all. So if the first part was kind of a, you know, choppy waters, and the second act was just people running and trying to find kids, the last 20 minutes did kind of salvage this for me. And I honestly wish I could just watch that when people ask me about this movie and I'd give it a flaming endorsement. But on the collective whole, it's fine, but it's just a summer movie. And I thought it could have been a little bit more than that, but may sound like a backhanded compliment. It's not the disaster I thought it was going to be, but I think the park should have done some more technical rehearsals before opening up. So I'm going to give it a 5. I think it's disposable. It's entertaining. I don't think it's the best of the sequels. I would rather watch 3 because that movie's 90 minutes. This one's, 2 hours. And I feel like it has a little bit more pretense than that one does. But it's not the worst thing I've had to sit through. And I certainly think it's better than The Lost World. It's weird that this movie feels more Spielbergian than the one that Spielberg actually directed.
Wow. 5 out of 10 from Gaudreau. You know, in watching this for this podcast, this was a different experience for me. In that, if I were to go back and review this, I would up at a point. I had a much better time watching this than I was expecting. Most of that, I think, is due to the fact that I think Jaffa and Silver, as well as Trevorrow and his writing partner, Derek Connolly, they all put together a pretty smart script when it comes to the attraction of dinosaurs to a park and the fact that these aren't actual dinosaurs, which again has never been called out before. I like that meta knowledge that they include in this script. At the same time, I don't like the humans. But when I go back and I think about it, the movies that the three of us have reviewed together in this series, I've never liked the humans, with the exception of Grant at times and Ian Malcolm, just because he was Jeff Goldblum and he was making jokes throughout the course of those movies. I never have really been a big fan of the humans of these films, and this doesn't change that. However, the smartness of the commercialization of this park and the attraction of the dinosaurs is what carries it. I will say, though, I mentioned earlier in this podcast that this is lacking something that it's trying to get at that the first film did so well, and that is the sense of wonder of these dinosaurs. No one is really impressed by the fact that there are dinosaurs at this park. They're just going for the attraction of it and the ability to ride a Stegosaurus. Nobody cares that we have these huge creatures that were 65 million years in the making, and it's there for the attraction. So that sense of wonder is gone. However, I have the same comparison that Adam does in the fact that this is a good popcorn film. This is a movie that you sit down and watch. I brought a lot of comparisons and parallelisms and things that the scriptwriters probably didn't intend to this podcast, just because I was noticing it as I was watching it. But this is something you could sit down, watch. This isn't going to melt your brain like those Transformers films do. It's a fun film. It's a fun watch. The final 20 minutes are pretty good. The connection to the humans, you're not going to really see that, but you're still going to have fun watching. So this is a 7 on 10 for me. That's the score I have written down, different than both of you. I had a fun time watching it. I think I just got myself into trouble by thinking about it too much. So 7 out of 10 for me. Next week is the last film in this series that I have seen. It is Jurassic Park Fallen Kingdom. I remember two things about next week's film, boys. I remember an auction, and I remember the fact that the dinosaurs just got completely wiped out at the beginning stages of it. Matt, what do you expect when we talk about Fallen Kingdom next week?
So I had no desire to see this when it was coming out, but I had a friend who I go to the movies with routinely, and when there's something that I don't want to see with him, he'll go and let me know if it's worth checking out. He texts me and he goes, "Tell me if this will sell you. Haunted house with dinosaurs." And I'm like, "Oh, I'm going." And I went like later that day and saw it. But the one thing that convinced me also, despite me not giving a shit about the movie itself, I really like the director. Unlike Colin Trevorrow, who I didn't know, I couldn't pick him out of a lineup. J.A. Bayona had done The Impossible, which I will never watch again, but it's a really well-made disaster movie. The Orphanage, which I loved. And A Monster Calls, which made me cry my eyes out to the point where someone asked me the next day if I was okay. So I was very excited to see him do his paycheck movie. I just wish it wasn't a Jurassic Park movie because I didn't see the correlation.
Adam, next week, Fallen Kingdom, what are you expecting?
I think we're going to fight. Really? For some reason, I just have the feeling that this movie is going to be one of those, Last Jedi, Rogue, like one of those. But I remember going into the film, I was excited at first they were making another one. I didn't think they necessarily needed to, but I was like, all right, let's go. I mean, it was clear after $1 billion that this movie was going to be made. And when you finish at 1.6, this franchise was never going to go extinct. But I felt like the trailers made me think this was Jurassic Park 2 all over again, where we were going to just end with getting dinosaurs on the mainland. I was like, well, fuck, I saw this film. So I wasn't excited, other than my kids are like, that's an opening day, right, Dad? That's one of those 7 o'clock Thursday night, right, Dad? So we loaded up. We were ready to go.
My hope in doing this series is that it ends better than our last couple. And I don't know how many hopes I have that it'll be that. Now, I haven't seen the one that preceded the one that we're going to be getting at the end of this retrospective, but at the time we record this, that new one comes out in a week. Matt, can this end any better than John Wick?
Remains to be seen, but I will say I like Gareth Edwards, despite me basically puking all over Rogue One. I like him more than Len Wiseman. But I also like John Wick far more than I like Jurassic Park as a franchise. Yeah. I certainly think it's more consistent.
But I'm saying, like, after Mission Impossible and John Wick, two downers to end that series.
Well, seem to be all we do with these new releases. Between those, between Dial of Destiny.
Oh, God, don't remind me of that.
Fast X, a Fantastic Beasts movie. I mean, outside of The Batman, the one that all of us gave a decent score to, and of course that's the one that's not going to get a sequel. I'm sorry, everyone. It's not going to fucking happen. So we're going to be stuck reviewing shit. And Transformers 1, they finally announced, oh yeah, the sequels aren't happening.
Yeah, that's not happening. Yeah, finally ended on a good one on that one.
And they finally get a good one, and I'm like, oh, I want to see where this goes.
Yeah.
And they give me the Stone Cold salute and stun me.
Adam, can this end any better than the series we have reviewed as of late?
I hope so, and I think it can. I mean, I think you got some pretty damn good people populating the new Jurassic World film. Rebirth, I guess, is what. It's amazing that technically that makes that a sextet, because they're not going to change it from Jurassic World to like Jurassic Planet or Jurassic Earth. But we'll see. I think the cast is good. Gareth Edwards, I think, can shoot a hell of a movie, but I don't know what kind of movie it is. It doesn't seem to be a sense of wonder. It seems to be an alien movie, you know, from the look. And you got ScarJo being Sigourney Weaver. Like, that's my feel of that movie. So I don't even know what it is, but I hope they brought something really fucking cool.
Well, we have 3 weeks before we review that one, but until next week when we get to Jurassic World Fallen Kingdom, watch your six. Raptors got a new podcast. Thank you, boys.
It's the T-Rex. Probably.
Thank you for listening to this edition of the Three Men in a Retrospective podcast, exclusively here on Percolated Media.
The titanosaur herd should be right across this valley.
Well, they're herbivores, right?
Yeah.
That's good.
But the things that hunt them aren't.
Come back every Friday as new retrospective reviews are posted weekly on your favorite podcast platform of choice.
Something's wrong. You're communicating.
Please visit and check out our Percolated Media Facebook page to get an advanced look at what the boys will be reviewing that week, as well as other things such as Matt and Garrett's wrestling podcast, what the site has in store for the future, some periodically done written reviews, and so much more.
That is one big pile of shit.
Check out the Percolated Media Archives, as we have tons of franchise reviews, including the films of the DC Universe featuring Batman and Superman, the Planet of the Apes franchise, Star Wars,
the ongoing Marvel series, the Alien franchise,
the Mad Max movies, Avatar,
the Mission Impossible film series,
and so many more.
No expense.
A Three Men in a Retrospective podcast is produced by Garrett and Matt.
You recording this thing?
The Three Men in a Retrospective podcast is edited by Garrett.
Mr. Work here didn't tell us everything that we need to know.
Scheduling done by Matt.
Let's face it, in your particular field, you're the top minds.
The Three Men and a Retrospective podcast is voice narrated by Adam.
Good job. You're making this look totally normal.
This podcast is not affiliated with any film studio or network, and all opinions expressed on the Three Men in a Retrospective podcast represents the opinions of that individual. Any similarities to any and all things associated with the films in question are strictly coincidental.
Kids okay?
I didn't ask. Why wouldn't they be?
Kids get scared.
What's to be scared? That's just a little hiccup in the power.
I didn't say I was scared.
I didn't say you were scared, I know.
The Three Men in a Retrospective podcast is an independently produced podcast, and it's thanks to the support of listeners like you that help keep it that way. Please like and subscribe, as well as leave a review on your favorite podcast platform of choice.
Nice rocket.
This podcast is a Percolated Media production. Copyright 2025, and any and all sound and audio clips are used for entertainment purposes only.
Well, what if we get the samples and we don't give them over to a company that makes a life-saving drug and then prices it so 99% of the planet can't afford it? Science is for all of us, not some of us. Have you thought about that?
I guess I haven't.
Well, then maybe you should start.
Maybe you should stop.
That's it.
What's going on?
Not much. I just noticed there's a bunch of arborists outside, so I wanted to hope if you start hearing noise, let me know so I can move.
There's what outside?
Arborists, people cutting trees.
Oh, okay.
So
yeah, that was my favorite Pokemon when I was a kid.
Boy, Matt's just on a roll. That's like three zingers in a row.
Really, if I was Disney, FF would be the Thanksgiving-y movie, because yeah, you need some space after losing fucking $500 million on your last two releases. Make it a family movie for Thanksgiving.
What the hell is FF?
Fantastic Four.
Oh.
Come on, Garrett, you got a history with that.
Yes, but we didn't have it go by FF. All right.
No, you had fucking fan four stick.
Yeah, that was much better. God damn it. Have you guys seen how much money this movie made? Holy shit.
Oh, God. Oh, yeah. My jaw hit the floor when I was doing my research again, because this is only my second time watching it.
Really?
Oh, wow.
Oh, we'll get into that.
All right.
Before we say, let's go.
Matt, countdown, sir. We get going. Adam, you took your kids to this. Did you guys see this in 3D?
No, not in any of them.
No, because I do think the 3D lends a lot.
I totally forgot that 3D was still a thing. I thought that had died by the time this came out. Because when you say 3D, I think of like from Avatar to... Yeah.
Avatar, Tron, and that's it. My Bloody Valentine. That's those three.
And Saw. I mean, say what you want about the Saw movies. They had fun with that 3D game.
Oh, that final chapter is so fun in 3D. So we cut to Nutta.
And Tim was the rumor of who one other character was actually going to be.
Best line ever is from that actor, that little kid from that first film. When that rumor was brought up to him, he said, "Oh, yeah, people like me don't grow up to look like Chris Pratt." Which I thought was wonderful.
Hey, well, it's funny because that kid looks exactly the same.
Just I know. He's really funny, though. I've seen him at cons. He's a really funny guy.
As somebody who's watching his way through Parks and Rec for the first time, Chris Pratt doesn't grow up to look like Chris Pratt.
No, well, once you get that Marvel paycheck, it comes with a personal trainer and the strictest diet plan you will ever ingest.
And I guess marrying into the Schwarzenegger family now doesn't hurt.
Oh, that's right. He did, didn't he?
I got to say, though, I'm glad the kids are going through this part because we get to see the theme park. I fucking hate these kids.
Oh, can we talk about this now since we've opened up?
All right, we'll open up that can of worms. Go ahead. Go ahead, Adam. Matt, go ahead.
No, Adam clearly has more to say.
All right.
I don't find there's... I got to say, though, I'm glad the kids are going through this park because we get to see the theme park. I fucking hate these kids.
Oh, can we talk about this now since we've opened up?
All right, we've opened up that can of worms. Go ahead. Go ahead, Adam. Matt, go ahead.
No, Adam clearly has more to say.
All right.
I don't find there's...
So if they went with that, maybe I would have given this some leeway. But yeah, the older brother's a poonhound, and this other kid makes Ralph Wiggum look like a member of Mensa.
Who the hell's Ralph Wiggum?
The kid from The Simpsons.
Oh,
Simpsons.
Shit.
I'm a dinosaur.
Yeah, and it's...
This is when she turns. This is when she's like, she turns and she's like, okay, I really like you.
Now it's like freaking Fast and Furious. Oh,
why do we have to keep bringing up that series?
Because it's all about family.
Another one.
That last film's never getting made.
And look, hey, if this had a crossover with Fast and Furious, nobody would question it.
Another movie that came out the same summer. The team arrived.
This fight lasts longer than most of Goldberg's fights, and I wasn't expecting the run in from the Mosasaurus to save the day.
Well, so, the T-Rex is about as old as Goldberg is now. So, and like Goldberg, the T-Rex could just show up and get a title shot right away. I'm like, fuck it, you win, movie.
Matt, can this end any better than John Wick?
Well, I know Wick's not over because we have a fifth one that's been announced.
Yeah, that depends on if you consider the end Ballerina or John Wick 4 as well.
Well,
is the end.
I'm saying as a podcast that we are doing as a series, we ended with Ballerina. Can this end better than that?
Remains to be seen, but